I'm Julia Metzger-Traber.
And I'm Tasha Haverty. Join us in the depths of mothers' hearts, minds, and stories
as we crack open the definitions of motherhood, listen for the unspeakable, and make space for the questions that rise.
What is a mother, we ask?
And everything answers.
Mother is a question. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I've got a quick favor to ask you. We are doing a listener survey to learn more about how you listen, what you like about our show, and maybe what we could improve on. It takes about 2 minutes to fill out, and we would be grateful if you did. You can find that survey at survey.prx.org/world. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. Thank you.
Experts are not ready to officially call what's happening in Gaza a famine. More important than what to call it, some say, is how to respond.
A famine response is not airdrops or food trucks. It's being able to, you know, have a real holistic treatment, and that's impossible to do in Gaza.
I'm Marco Werman. On today's show, the dire need for food and care in Gaza. We'll also get reactions from across the globe to last night's debate. No doubt, some countries enjoyed it.
You could probably argue that autocrats around the world are looking at the US and looking at the West and laughing at the moment and liking what they see.
Plus, government-sponsored dating in Japan and a look back at the first time Paris hosted the Olympics, 1900. All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being here this Friday. News from the war in Gaza. Israel has allowed 68 people, 19 children and their companions, to leave the Gaza Strip. This is a medical evacuation, the first since early May. Palestinian health officials say thousands more people need medical treatment abroad and that hundreds of those cases are urgent. Chief among health risks for Palestinians in Gaza is hunger. And the U.S. military's plan now to remove the pier for humanitarian aid means one less way for relief to get into Gaza. Experts say the situation is catastrophic, but the international organization that determines when a famine exists says one has not officially started in Gaza, which raises the question of how bad things have to get for the famine label to apply. The World's Aaron Schachter reports.
First of all, you need to know that famine is complicated. Tess Ingram from UNICEF says famine, like, say, genocide, has a very specific set of criteria, and it's determined by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification System, or IPC for short.
They're a group of international experts who analyze data to determine when the situation descends into a famine, and they define famine as an extreme deprivation of food.
The IPC gathers information and grades it based on a 5-point scale: normal, stressed, crisis, emergency, and catastrophe. That would be famine. Reports about the risk of famine in Gaza began to emerge not long after Israel launched its attack on the northern part of the Gaza Strip. Over the months, food deprivation has spread, but Ingram says there has yet to be a famine anywhere.
The process of classifying a famine is a very thorough and data-driven process that is put together by this expert group called the IPC and then reviewed by another group called the Famine Review Committee. And so it is a very technical process that can be confusing.
Thing is, though, if the IPC can't get the data, then the group can't do an assessment. And right now, data in Gaza is hard to come by. Ingram says it is important to have the different designations of famine because it helps explain the severity of any given situation. But often the problem of starvation or famine arises before the data shows it exists.
So we have this terrible situation whereby the word famine has become more of a problem than a solution.
Alex Duval is executive director of the World Peace Foundation, based at Tufts University outside Boston.
In our experience, policymakers, politicians, you know, senior United Nations officials and others only respond when you cry famine. If you say food emergency, they say, oh, okay, tell us when it's famine, you know, just don't disturb us for now.
Duval says by December, the situation in Gaza was absolutely appalling. In fact, the Famine Review Committee of the IPC said they'd never seen a situation get so bad so fast.
You know, it's a humanitarian catastrophe. Kids are dying. The society is being traumatized, torn apart, you know, rendered destitute. There's massive risk of epidemics. But somehow, if you don't use the F word, doesn't somehow count. And I think that's a problem.
The difference between the classification of 4 and 5, at the end of the day, on the ground, people are still dying.
Bushra Khalidi is with the humanitarian organization Oxfam. She heads its office in the occupied Palestinian territories. She, too, understands the need for classifications. But she says if world leaders need to wait for the F word to be declared, then that's a stain on their own consciences. Whether there is a famine or not, the situation in Gaza, Khalidi says, has been horrifying for months, and people are starving. 300 or 400 trucks of aid isn't going to change that.
A famine response is not airdrops or food trucks. That's not what, when we're responding to an entire population starving, what it looks like is rebuilding hospitals. It's getting doctors for people. It's getting dietitians. It's being able to, you know, have a real holistic treatment.
In its recent report, the Famine Review Committee more or less agreed. They said while they couldn't call the situation in Gaza a famine, quote, extreme human suffering is without a doubt currently ongoing in the Gaza Strip, and they said it was imperative to address the civilian suffering. For The World, I'm Aaron Schachter.
This week, Kenya began deploying police officers to Haiti. They are part of a UN-backed multinational mission to deal with the rampant gang violence there. Kenya's President William Ruto addressed the police before they set off.
The international community has confidence in you, your capabilities, your integrity, your professionalism.
But inside Kenya, the police have simultaneously been facing serious criticism for their deadly crackdown on anti-tax demonstrations over the past 2 weeks. The World's Halima Gikande reports from Nairobi.
At the city morgue in Nairobi, Kenya, families have come to identify the bodies of their loved ones who were killed in this week's anti-tax demonstrations. 19-year-old Ibrahim Kamau Wanjiko was one of them. His mother, Edith Wanjiko Kamau, struggles to hold her tears back. When her son didn't come back from Tuesday's demonstrations, she went from hospital to hospital until she was told that the dead had been brought to this public mortuary. That's where she found her son. He and 5 others died from bullet wounds. At Tuesday's protest, the police fired at unarmed demonstrators. This has surprised all of us. My son was a strong person. He had just finished high school last year and was trying to make ends meet as she looked for the funds to send him to college. Many young people have lost their lives over these finance bill demonstrations, she says. According to the Police Reforms Working Group, at least 23 people have been killed by police during these protests. 300 people have been injured. Patrick Mutahi is a police and security expert and the executive director of the Center for Human Rights and Policy Studies.
Definitely, this has damaged the public image of the president and how he wants to portray himself nationally, internationally.
As the anti-tax demonstrations heated up over the past week, Ruto commended protesters for exercising their rights. On the streets, however, they were met with tear gas, abductions, and live bullets.
And that kind of brutality towards the state, showing a lot of its muscle, and saying that, you know, we take this as treasonous. But then also it was not proportionate to the threat that is there.
These events are bringing renewed attention to Kenya's long history of police brutality. It's made many people question why the country's police are going to Haiti. Mutahi says Kenya's policing woes are not new.
Our mentality, one of the police, is drawn from the colonial times of abjugating citizens. And we have never changed our style of policing. The police first think their work is to brutalize Kenyans.
Over the years, Kenya has received money from the international community, including the United States, to train and reform their police. Last year, a government task force was created to tackle police reforms. But Mutahi says reform efforts often don't address the root of the problem.
When you talk about police reform, we always talk about reforming the hardware, is that we are giving them better equipment, we are giving them better gear. We are increasing the numbers, but we rarely touch what does policing mean to people.
On Wednesday, President Ruto recognized and apologized for the loss of life during the protests.
On those who lost their lives, there will be a mechanism of how they will be accounted for.
I reached out to Kenya's police service for comment for this story. I was directed to an independent police oversight authority that investigates police misconduct. The organization says they are investigating some of the deaths allegedly caused by police. Back at the morgue, I asked Jane Waithera, the grandmother of one of the victims shot dead during these demonstrations, what her message was for Kenya's president.
Tunaomba, Your Excellency, tafadhali.
Mr. President, if you listen to the voices of the young people, the demonstrations will finish. But I beg you, don't let more children die. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi, Nairobi.
Leopold Sédar Senghor is a monumental figure in the history of Senegal and of modern Africa. He was Senegal's first president after independence, as well as an intellectual and a celebrated poet. Senghor was also an avid book collector, and most of his personal library has been in France the past few decades. But now it's returning to Senegal's capital, Dakar. To talk about the significance of that collection and the symbolic meaning of its move from France to Senegal, we're joined by Kelly Duke Bryant, an associate professor of history at Rowan University. She joins us from New Jersey. How meaningful, Kelly, is it for Senegal to have this book collection of its first president returned?
Well, I think it's actually monumental. It's really a huge and hugely significant moment for Senegalese historians and for scholars of Senegalese literature and also just for the Senegalese public.
Yeah, I mean, his Venn diagram of politician and kind of this figure in literature is unique. Can you talk a little bit about that legacy and the connection between literature and politics in Senghor's time?
Well, yeah. So Senghor was part of this generation of Black intellectuals who were really influenced by cultural and intellectual production among Black intellectuals across the Atlantic, and actually also in his case, the French Empire, the Francophone world. And many of them were present with each other in Paris in the 1930s. Senghor was there attending school and then ultimately teaching. And in that place, he met Aimé Césaire, who was a Martinican intellectual, and Léon Damas, who was from a French Guiana. And together, the three of them developed this sort of philosophy and cultural output called Negritude. And this was a moment where these intellectual figures, they came together to think about the meaning of what it meant to be Black in the Francophone world in particular, but in the world more broadly in this period of time. And so a lot of the literary output that dates from the 1930s and the Negritude movement has to do with that question.
Yeah, so with that background, I'm really curious to know what this collection that's returning to Dakar actually contains. Does anything stand out to you as especially telling?
Well, so one of the things that I thought was particularly interesting is there's apparently a book in the collection by Claude McKay, who was a Harlem Renaissance writer, a Jamaican-American Black writer. There's a book by Aimé Césaire, one of Senghor's friends, and as I mentioned, the kind of co-founder of the Negritude movement, general works on philosophy, on French literature and politics, historical works. So it's a lot of different things. And I think one of the things that scholars are so excited about is this having access to this collection as a whole allows them some insight into what Senghor was thinking, what he was interested in collecting. Some of his own annotations and markings are in the books and in their margins or underlinings in the books themselves. So having them together is also crucial.
I mean, it strikes me that this collection could be revelatory to a better understanding of Senegal's own modern history following French colonialism. How do you see this library being used in Senegal now that it'll be there?
Yeah, so I've read that there are plans in the works to create a museum dedicated to Senghor's life and legacy, and that the hope is that this collection would be housed there. But I think in terms of its significance to the Senegalese people, there has been an ongoing discussion and movement to repatriate African objects, particularly African art objects that are housed in major museums or private collections in other countries. Many of these items, of course, when you're talking about art objects, were looted or stolen during the period of colonial conquest or colonial rule. You know, Senghor's collection is a little bit different in that he collected it himself during the time that he was living in France. But I do think it can be seen in this larger context of repatriating African objects and artifacts, and now also libraries, to the places that they, in one way or another, originated. And I think it's important in that sense as well, and will be important to the Senegalese population to have that material back in Senegal.
Kelly Duke Bryant is an associate professor of history at Rowan University in New Jersey. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Japan is entering what some sociologists call a marriage ice age. In past decades, most people in Japan got hitched. But these days, about a third of Japanese age 40 and under haven't even been in a romantic relationship. So the Japanese government is intervening. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
I'm in a Tokyo suburb on the heels of a local administrator. She's leading me up some stairs into her office. Inside, there are about a half dozen employees, all women wearing fuzzy slippers, tapping away at computers. They each rise and say hello.
Konnichiwa, konnichiwa.
These office workers have a profound mission, facilitating the creation of human life, starting from square one. They are matchmakers at the Saitama Marriage Support Center. Saitama is a prefecture. If Tokyo is New York, Saitama is like New Jersey. Most Japanese prefectures now offer matchmaking services through the local government. This center opened 6 years ago. Akuto Kayo is the center's top administrator. She says Japan has a very low birth rate, a problem the government has called the country's biggest crisis. Akuto's mission is to help reverse this trend. More marriages, she says, should lead to more kids. But do people in Japan find it odd to seek government help in finding romance? Akuto says each year her center gets about 5,000 applicants. So apparently not. Even a generation ago, she says, Japan still had a lively tradition of old-school matchmaking through parents or an auntie. Akuto says this is just the modern version. To apply for marriage support, a single person needs a selfie, proof of their income, and patience to answer 112 questions online. They range from, how tall are you, and do you smoke, to, if you make a mistake and someone points it out, do you try to fix it? The answers are fed into the Marriage Support Center's algorithm. Akuto Kayo calls it the AI. The AI doesn't give you a score, she says. It just matches you to the ideal partner. Just a little over 2 years ago, a young woman named Erina Aoki was slogging through that questionnaire. She tells me about it through a translator.
I remember it was like a personality test, but there were so many questions, I was getting rather bored with it.
Erina was nearly 30 at the time, living with her mom. She had a good job at an architecture firm, but she couldn't find a decent guy, certainly not on the popular dating apps.
When you are over 30 years old, most of the people you think are good guys are already taken by somebody else.
At least with government matchmaking, men must provide their real identity, real photo, real height, real salary. Also, it's called marriage support, and that weeds out guys just trying to hook up. Erina submitted her answers, and the AI matched her with Sora Kato, a chemistry teacher, 3 years younger than her.
From the photo, I could tell that he's an honest person, and also he had a good income, and that gave me a sense of reassurance.
Unlike Tinder, the system would not let them chat online beforehand. Instead, the AI spat out a day and time and a location, a cafe called Cozy Corner. It told them, go on a date. Erina was giddy. Her mom helped her pick out a stunning lavender dress. Looking awesome, she headed to Cozy Corner.
My first impression of him, he was so suntan. Oh my gosh. I'm sorry about this, but I was told that he was younger than me. But when I first saw him, I thought, is he just around the same age or even older?
Wait, there's more.
I think he was wearing checkered shirt. His fashion style is rather dull.
Akuto Kayo, the administrator at Saitama Marriage Support Center, says some male applicants do need help looking more presentable. At the center, men can come in for a 30-minute advice session with one of her friendly staff members. She's telling me how some men submit profile pics with a big shadow over their face. It doesn't look inviting, she says. Staff will help them take a brighter, smileier selfie. Now, to be fair, Erina's date, Sora, didn't need that much help. His fashion sense was basic, but he was a good listener. Also, the suntan was from teaching tennis to school kids. Erina is sporty too. So, they started to click.
For me, I felt like I was meeting an old friend of mine that I've known him even before this.
After the date, the AI asked, are you up for another one? Both clicked yes. And only then did the system reveal Erina's full name to Sora and more of her biographical details. That's because the government has built-in anti-creep safeguards. If a man gets obsessed with a woman after the first date and she's not into him, he has no way to find and harass her. As for Erina and Sora, their second date went really well. So did the third and the fourth. Then they went on a getaway to Mount Fuji, where Erina got food poisoning. Sora went into super boyfriend mode, running to 7-Eleven to get her medicine. Sora told me, yeah, I was really into her. She gets me, he says. She's kind. She opens up new horizons for me. He says, it's so attractive. Eventually, Erina said to him, here's the deal. When you propose, do it in a fancy restaurant with a bundle of roses. So he did exactly that. They got married 10 months ago. That's the couple in traditional Japanese robes walking out to greet guests on their wedding day. They've been really happy ever since. By the way, Sora's not-so-great fashion sense, totally fixable.
Well, I've given him bags and clothes, and we go to the same hairdresser now, so I would say he has shown great improvement.
This government-supported romance has a happy ending. But is the whole process worth it to the Japanese taxpayer? Well, the Saitama Marriage Center tells me in the last 6 years, it's set up more than 12,000 dates. But that has led to less than 500 marriages. And as for babies, Akuto Kayo says, for privacy reasons, the center deletes every applicant's file once they find a partner. They don't really know if they're increasing the birth rate. I asked Erina and Sora directly, would you like to have kids?
Yes, I would say we can have a child soon.
Erina adds that she brought up kids on that very first date. But Sora says, no, I said I wanted kids first. They agree to disagree. They haven't even been married a year, but Erina and Sora already sound like a true married couple. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Saitama, Japan.
The story is part of our project covering demographic changes in Japan. Check out the Japan in Focus section of our website, theworld.org. We'll be back with more in the second half of the show. You're listening to The World. In South Africa, rhinoceros poaching is a problem because rhino horns are worth a lot of money. We'll hear from a radiation expert, surprisingly, who's got a unique plan to stop the poaching.
People say, oh, somebody should do something about this. And it was, again, one of those thoughts, well, maybe that somebody is me.
That's still ahead here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It was a debate for American voters, but last night's encounter between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump has made headlines across the globe. To get more on how the rest of the world has been reacting to the hour and 40-minute event, we're joined by The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry. Orla, you're in Madrid, and you've been tracking reaction across the continent. What are you hearing about last night's debate?
And I should point out that most right-thinking people, Marco, on the continent slept through the debate last night. It was on live 3 a.m. at 3 a.m. our time. The reactions, probably not all that different from the US, but I think what it has done is maybe made the idea of a second Trump presidency appear much more of a possibility now in the minds of many here in the EU. Most of the news headlines, though, have been focusing on Biden's performance. So in the UK, the Financial Times and the Times of London, their headline this morning was pretty much the same. Both newspapers ran with the headline, "Democrats panic as Biden stumbles." The Guardian was asking the question, who could replace Joe Biden? In Sweden, you had the national broadcaster there describing the debate as near catastrophic. Finland, their national broadcaster called it a disaster. Le Monde in France called it a shipwreck. He said President Biden was raspy and sometimes halting, although we should say that a source within the Democratic Party said that President Biden was suffering from a cold last night. In terms of reactions from politicians themselves in Europe, Donald Tusk in Poland, he was asked about it in Brussels this afternoon. He said, "I was afraid of this. It was to be expected that in a debate, it would not be easy for President Biden." And then some are more blunt. Kim Darroch, he was the British ambassador to the US from 2016 to 2019 during the Trump years. He was asked on BBC Radio this morning about what he thought Joe Biden should do now.
I think he should stand aside. I mean, this was a historically bad performance. He was inaudible, incoherent. He lost his train of thought several times. Some of his answers made simply no sense. As I understand it, he can only be replaced if he voluntarily stands down. It's very difficult otherwise, but I think he should stand down. I think it's very hard to see him winning now.
Orla, I know you had your eyes outside of Europe as well. What sorts of reactions are you seeing? I mean, I imagine the leaders in some countries were more troubled than others by what they saw.
Yeah, I was just looking in China earlier this morning, presidential debate. It was the top trending topic on Weibo, the social media platform there. And the view that was being repeated a lot today there was that the debate was a bad reflection of Western democracy. But it wasn't just people in China who were saying this is not a great advertisement for global democracy. Economist Timothy Ash, he's based at Chatham House, a think tank in London, and I asked him for his view earlier.
You know, there needs to be something better than this. You could also look at the US electoral process and how it's so dependent on a small number of voters, 100,000 or so voters in a number of these key or battleground states, which, again, is pretty extraordinary, not particularly a great advertisement for democracy. So you could probably argue that autocrats around the world are looking at the US and looking at the West and laughing at the moment and liking what they see.
Yeah. Now, Russia and Vladimir Putin came up a lot in that hour and a half or so. Was there much of a reaction in Russia or Ukraine today to what both candidates said, or just how much was said?
Yeah, the quote from Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesperson this afternoon, was that Vladimir Putin enjoyed a lie-in this morning. He didn't watch the debate, according to Peskov. He said, "Without irony, I should add that Russia has never interfered in electoral campaigns and has no intention at all of commenting on the debate." Russian media itself did cover it. They ran a tally on how many times Russia and Putin were mentioned by both candidates, but they concluded that Biden had failed in his performance. In Ukraine, the media that I saw gave a slightly more balanced response. The Kyiv Post, for example, said that neither President Biden nor Trump had articulated a stance on the war that was different from either of their previously stated positions. And then another Ukrainian outlet just said, "We're no clearer now what US policy towards Ukraine will be after the presidential election in November."
The World's Orla Barry, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
If you live in Iran, it's dangerous to criticize the government. The same is true for Iranians living outside the country. Critics have been kidnapped and even assassinated. Reporter Fariba Nawa is in Istanbul, where she's been investigating the suspicious death of one Iranian dissident who fled Iran and settled in neighboring Turkey. Fariba wanted to learn everything she could about how Iran's plots against dissidents operate. She ended up speaking with a guy with firsthand knowledge of how these things work. He had been the target himself of an Iranian kidnapping ring. His name is Mohammad Rezaei, and he served as an officer in the Iranian Navy for 17 years. After turning against the military and going AWOL, he escaped to the seaside town of Yalova in Turkey and started working at a kebab shop. But he knew Tehran was looking for him, and then things got weird. I'll let Fariba take it from here.
He says it started with Hakan Salem, the cook who didn't know how to cook. He had a brother and several cousins. They were the Salem family. And they became regulars at the restaurant. Hakan was fired a few days after he started working as a cook. But that didn't stop him from coming to the kebab shop to talk to Rezaei. At first, Hakan said, I have friends who send people from Turkey to Canada. I can help you. Rezaei says he didn't believe him. And also, his offers were presumptuous. I didn't share with him that I was a refugee and looking for a way out, he says. It was Hakan's brother Ismail who was more persuasive. Ismail could speak English. That was the easiest way for Rezaei to communicate. Ismail would say things like, you shouldn't work here at this restaurant, and he'd offer to take him abroad. Rezaei says, I tried to cut them off. I was 60% sure that these guys were suspicious, that there was a problem. Then one night, Ismail and another solemn cousin named Muharram came to see Rezaei. They had news. He says, they met on the street of the restaurant as I was leaving on my bike at night. We have your documents ready, they said. Our goal is to rescue and save you. Rezaei decided to be frank. I told him my mental condition is not good, and if you're planning to turn me over to Iran, I'll end my life first, and I won't cause Iran any harm, he says.
If they were going to take you back to Iran, you had pills and you were going to swallow them. Yeah. And you'd rather die than be punished in military prisons in Iran. Yeah.
Yes, he says. I told Ismail several times.
What did he say? What was his response?
He denied it, and he said, you're my brother. I have kids. I wouldn't lie to you. It was a few weeks later that Rezaei met the fourth guy who would try to kidnap him. Once again, he was leaving the restaurant on his bike. It was night, and a Turkish guy started talking to him behind the restaurant. He introduced himself as Angel, which wasn't his real name. He was actually another Salem, a cousin, the leader of the Salem family. His name is Ehsan. Rezaei didn't know any of this at the time. He seemed drunk or was playing the part of a drunk, Rezaei says. Rezaei and Ehsan smoked cigarettes and walked. It didn't take long for Ehsan to offer to take Rezaei abroad. Rezaei said it freaked him out. This is when things started to get scary. Several nights later on his bike ride home, Rezaei spotted Ismail Salem driving a BMW. A few minutes later, he sees the BMW again, and he realizes the drunk angel, Ehsan Salem, is sitting next to Ismail in the passenger seat of the BMW. The Salems had cut him off. I stopped and got off the bicycle to walk, Rezaei says. The BMW pulled up next to him. Ehsan rolled down the window. Do you know me? He asked.
Ehsan با اون خودروی خودش پیچید جلوی من.
و من سری شناختمش با اینکه لباساش عوض شده بود کت شلوار.
I barely recognized him because he was wearing a suit, Rezai says. But I said, yes, I remember you. You came that night and you seemed a bit drunk. Then two of the car doors swung open. Ismail and another Salam, yet another cousin who Rezai didn't know, his name was Erdal, got out of the car. There were so many Salams. They came toward me, Rezai says. I realized that they were going to grab me and throw me in the car. I let go of my bike and it fell. They said, get in the car. We want to talk to you. I said, I'm not coming with you guys. I stood there ready to fight back, but then Ismail switched tactics. He said, no need. Rezai is my friend, and I'll convince him. Ismail told Rezai, you're in danger. Iranian intelligence has plans to kidnap you. They said they'll show up in a white transporter van and get you.
و دیگه توی راهی که می رفتیم با احسان تا سر اون کوچه که بعدش یه 10 دقیقه سر اون کوچه وایسادیم که
اسماعیل and his cousin Erdal got back in the BMW and then Ehsan, the leader of the family, gets out of the car. He started to walk with Rezai down the street, trying to convince him to get in the car. They reached a street corner. This part was captured by a CCTV camera. It shows Ehsan Salam yelling at Rezai, and Rezai is laughing. The story they were creating for me was funny, he says. I couldn't believe they could so stupidly execute this. But even though he thought they were stupid, Rezai says he was still scared. He said his laughing was an act. He was playing calm. He decided to appease them. He said, okay, he'd go abroad with them. They could take him.
و بعد دیگه گفت که میتونی حالا سوار ماشین بشیم عکس بگیری فلان عکس بگیریم گفتم باش اونم مشکل نداره من که
Ehsan said get in the car we want to take a picture with you so Rezai did he got in the car
Reporter Fariba Nawa in Yalova, Turkey. The story is part of an investigation called Lethal Descent from The World and our partner On Spec. Look for the full episodes each Friday in The World's podcast feed. Next week, Mohammad Rezai tells Fariba what happened next in the kidnapping, and she investigates the strange story of one of the people wrapped up in the operation, an American. South Africa is a hotspot for wildlife poaching, and one thing that can get poachers a lot of money on black markets, rhinoceros horn. In a new effort to deter poachers from going after rhino horns, South African scientists are injecting the horns with radioactive material. Professor James Larkin at the University of the Witwatersrand has just treated the horns of 20 rhinos. James, this is a fascinating thing you're starting to do, but let me start with a basic question. How big a problem is the illegal trade of rhino horn, and who is buying?
It's a massive problem. Over the last couple of years, we've seen the rate of poaching starting to rise again. That last year, there were 450 animals poached. All of that horn is going to the Far East. It's used in small parts for traditional medicine, but in large part nowadays, it's seen as a status symbol of great wealth to be displayed in your office and things like that. And frankly, we don't want it to happen because it's decimating the population of rhino here in South Africa.
Right, because when a poacher takes a rhino horn, the animal is killed in the process, correct?
Almost always the animal is killed, and very violently the horn is chopped out of the skull of the animal. It's a disgusting process if you've ever had seen the aftermath of it.
So where did this idea come from, to make rhino horns radioactive?
My background is in radiation protection and nuclear security, and I knew there was a global network of radiation portal monitors at harbors, airports, border crossings and things like that. And I realized perhaps if I put a small quantity of radioactive material into the horn, small enough to not harm the animal, but just large enough to set off these detectors, that this is going to have a multiple effect, because we could make the horn radioactive and tell the world African rhino horn is radioactive. And so those people who wanted to have rhino horn to display and to give as gifts to engender favor with colleagues, they wouldn't want it because people have a real visceral aversion to anything that might be radioactive.
Right, and no poacher or their associates would want to go through that detector. And James, how do you know this is safe for the rhinos?
Because I've spent the last 2 years doing very careful. First of all, I had to create a digital model of the rhino's head using up-to-date modern software used in the medical industry. And then I've used software from the nuclear industry to do very detailed dose calculations. We've taken a very careful and calculated path because, you know, these animals are rare. They are valuable to the entire ecosystem of Africa. So we've got to be ultra cautious and be the proper custodians for these animals.
Your project, aptly named Rhizotope, just treated the horns of 20 rhinos. How'd you actually go about it?
It's quite a simple process with direct veterinary supervision. The vet will anesthetize and tranquilize the rhino. Then we make a hole in the horn, insert the isotopes into it, seal the horn up, cover the horn then in data dots, because this is a spray that you can spray and it's got 11,000 microchips embedded into the glue. You spray that onto the horn. So we have a belt and braces approach, because not only have you got micro dots on there, we have the radioisotopes on there. There is also an RFID chip inserted into the horn and into the shoulder of these animals, which has a unique number to the animal, which is then tied back to a DNA database.
There are estimates of some 15,000 rhinos I see in South Africa. What do you guess the impact is going to be when poachers and illegal traders hear that some rhinos have radioactive horns?
Well, I'm hoping that there is a catastrophic fall in the rate of demand for rhino horn. Let the people go and demonstrate their fabulous wealth by endowing a children's wing at a hospital or something like that, rather than, you know, by destroying the life of an animal.
James, just a personal question, one you started to get into a moment ago. How different has this work been from your usual work as a nuclear scientist?
Oh, chalk and cheese. I mean, 5 years ago, had you asked me, you know, am I getting into conservation? The answer would have been no. And now I'm got my feet firmly in the conservation world.
James Larkin there. He's director of the Radiation and Health Physics Unit at WITS. That's the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It goes without saying, the Olympic Games are a huge spectacle. You've got, of course, the incredible displays of athletic excellence, but there's also the pomp of opening ceremonies. The upcoming Paris Olympic Games have a budget in the multi-billion dollar range and some 45,000 volunteers to pull off the whole production. But the Olympics were not always organized on such a grandiose scale. The World's Bianca Hillier takes a look back at the first two times Paris hosted the world's best athletes.
Athletes usually dedicate their entire lives to make it to the Olympics.
But, you know, in 1896, 1900, they just happened to be in town.
David Walachinsky is the co-founder of the International Society of Olympic Historians. He says in the first few iterations of the modern games, the Olympics didn't have great brand recognition. So in 1900, when Paris first hosted the games alongside the World's Fair, the fair took center stage.
Some of the people didn't know they were competing in the Olympics.
They simply thought they were taking part in the athletic section of the World's Fair. In their defense, the events looked nothing like the Olympics we know today.
The competitions took place between mid-May to the end of October, really spread out.
Paula Nichols works for the Canadian Olympic Committee and is a lifelong fan of the Games. She says the 1900 Olympics lasted 10 times longer than today's edition, and the number of athletes was 10 times less than we see now. Not even 1,000 competitors showed up, and only 22 were women.
So that's just how it's grown over the years.
Back in 1900, there were no opening or closing ceremonies either, and there were no Paralympics whatsoever. Perhaps the only similarity between the 1900 Paris Olympics and the ones taking place this summer is the fact that some events will be in the Seine. The river was open for public swimming at the time, and historian David Walachinsky says that's where one of the enduring mysteries from the 1900 Games took place.
In the coxed pair rowing, the Dutch team grabbed a kid out of the crowd because he was light and made him the coxswain.
The random kid led the team to victory, and the Dutch won gold.
A photograph was taken of these two huge Dutch rowers and this little boy, and then he just disappeared. And to this day, we don't know his name. And Olympic historians are obsessed with finding out who this kid is. Just a few days ago, somebody sent an email around with a lead.
So the youngest ever Olympian remains unnamed. By the time 1924 came around and the Games returned to Paris, Paula Nichols says a lot had changed.
It's getting a little closer to what we know these days. Official opening and closing ceremonies. An Olympic Village was built for the first time. Press were there. There was a radio broadcast for the first time.
These were the first Olympics with widespread appeal. Archival video shows stadiums packed with people watching athletics and water polo. Even Hollywood took notice.
Get set.
The Games showed up on the silver screen in Chariots of Fire, the Oscar-winning film about Eric Liddell. He won gold on the track for Great Britain in 1924. So did Finland's Paavo Nurmi. The Flying Finn, as he was called, is still the only athlete to win 5 gold medals on the track at a single Olympics. Despite the 1924 Games being much more popular than in years past, still only 4% of the athletes were women. Now, 100 years later, that number is way up.
Paris 2024 will be the first Olympic Games with full gender equality on the field of play.
The International Olympic Committee celebrated the news in a video released on International Women's Day. The IOC says 50% of the athletes will be women and 50% men. They do not track statistics for other gender identities. More than 10,000 competitors will head to Paris this summer, with millions watching live in the stands and billions expected to watch from home.
For 2 weeks or 3 weeks this summer, Paris is going to be the center of the world.
Lucas Obeen researches sports and geopolitics at the Institute for International and Strategic Relations in Paris.
In general, for a city to host Olympics, it's something really good to improve the picture of itself.
He says the general public associates sports with entertainment and fair play. So cities often use the games to boost their reputation. But increased viewership also means more pressure.
There is a big change for Paris this summer.
The city has made major public promises, like delivering the most environmentally friendly games ever and cleaning up the Seine. Fans and stakeholders across the globe will be watching to see if organizers deliver on those promises when Paris hosts the games this summer for the third time. Competition is set to start on July 24th. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
France is waiting not just for the Summer Games, but also in a last-minute move for summer elections. French President Emmanuel Macron called a snap legislative election earlier this month. Voting begins this Sunday. Candidates have been making final campaign pushes today. It is a risky move for centrist Macron, with rising support for the far right in his country. The outcome could change the entire course of his presidency, not to mention the future of France. We'll be looking at those results on Monday. And staying with the French vibe before we leave you today. A French vibe on this side of the Atlantic. Montreal, it's time for this year's edition of the City's Jazz Festival. 10 days of concerts, some free, some ticketed. This is Québécois singer Dominique Fils-Aimé. She's been on the scene there since 2015, when she competed in the French-Canadian version of The Voice, La Voix. This weekend, Fils-Aimé takes the stage at the Jazz Festival, where she'll perform songs from her latest release, Our Roots Run Deep. And this number, Moi Je T'aime, Me, I Love You. Non, je ne serai plus là. Thank you.
pour toute ta prise de tête. Non, je ne serai plus là, 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 là pour danser avec toi.
Moi, Je T'aime is actually the first single in French from Dominique Fils-Aimé. Born and raised in Montreal to parents who emigrated from Haiti, but Fils-Aimé's artistic sensibilities led her to sounds and lyrics that have their start in the U.S., blues, jazz, and soul. Catching her live would be a pretty good reason to head to Montreal to check out what the Jazz Festival has to offer. We leave you today with Dominique Fils-Aimé. The World comes to you Monday through Friday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Online 24/7 at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Have a restful weekend. We'll be back right here with you on Monday.
Je t'aime, je ne serai plus là.